Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. In mid-November, scientists from across Canada met in Edmonton for the Sustainable Forest Management Conference. Among the many participants was Dr. Tom Rostovsky, the president of NSERC, the foremost scientific funding agency in the country. And Dr. Suzanne Bailey presented some surprise findings about the role of beavers in maintaining wetland water quality. And rural economist Dr. Vic Adamovich and postdoctoral researcher Marion Weber introduced the controversial notion of tradable land use permits to protect biodiversity. And conservation biologist Dr. Rick Schneider talked about his new book on alternative forest strategies. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. There probably isn't a scientist in this country who at some time hasn't received funding from NSERC, the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada. Dr. Tom Rostovsky is the president of NSERC, and his luncheon speech on the first day of the Sustainable Forest Management Conference in Edmonton focused on Canada's innovation strategy. Canada's goal is to move from 15th place as a research nation to 5th by the year 2010. After his speech, I had an opportunity to ask Tom Rostovsky what role NSERC is playing in pushing forward the idea of innovation.
Well, NSERC has pushed it forward in three ways, and our motto displays that. Our motto is investing in people, discovery, and innovation. So investing in people, we support senior undergraduate students who have a first exposure to research, master's students, doctoral students, and postdoctoral students. We support them during their studies. We invest in the development of researchers as well by providing guidance through our peer review processes to them. Discovery is our basic research program. It's the basis of everything else we do. It's our largest program. And there are grants given to close to 9,000 professors across the country who do the research and supervise students. And innovation, we promote in two ways. First, in project research involving partnerships between industry and university researchers. This is research done to solve problems that industry has today that can't be solved with today's knowledge. So new knowledge is needed. And secondly, commercializing the ideas out of basic research, because in the partnership with industry, industry is there to commercialize, but in basic research, researchers alone.
Do we really need NSERC, though?
Absolutely. If you need two of us, or one of us twice as large. Every country, every Western country, and some Eastern countries that have aspirations to raise the standard of living of their citizens have organizations very much like ours to do very much what we do. That is to develop the capacity not just to generate their own ideas, but also to understand what everybody else is doing around the world. This is what I pointed out in the 96% and the 4% arrows. So yes, it's a stamp of industrialized civilization that these things are done almost exactly the same way everywhere.
You're here today addressing a gathering of the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is one of the centers of excellence. How have things come along in your viewpoint or your perspective since this program started just a few years ago?
Well, I think that because we've had to, given our geography and the fact that we have a dilute population, we have learned how to network to create an intellectual critical mass to deal with problems that are large in scale, extensive in scale, and very rich in complexity. We've learned how to do that, and a number of other countries are starting to nose around the NCE model and try to pick it up. I think the program has been a great success from that point of view. It needs more funding. We have 22 networks funded at an average of $3.5 million a year each. That's not enough, because some of these networks involve 100 professors who are researchers, and that money really isn't a very significant addition to their research capacity. But the network concept is working, and it's working well, and it's uniquely Canadian.
What do you think is needed then in order to reach this goal of being able to move us from, say, 15th place to 5th and really focus on innovation?
This may sound like a tired word, but I really think the word leadership is the right word, and it's leadership at many levels. Leadership in the sectors of industry, where it might be a new idea. Leadership in government. Leadership at the level of federal-provincial relations so that the country marches together. You know, regional and provincial differences if necessary, but not necessarily regional and provincial differences. That's really required because we're not inventing something that nobody else has thought of here. We're competing. We're trying to move from 15th place to 5th in a league in which everybody else is trying to move up too. So, you know, 16 on down are trying to pass us and 14 on up are trying to stay ahead of us. This is going to take a serious effort by everybody working together.
What is it that you're specifically trying to do if you looked at what the one main thing would be, saying being your legacy or your vision of bringing all of this forward, what would it be?
Recognizing that the relative importance of university research for Canada's future is far greater than its relative importance in other countries because we lack some institutions. We have very little corporate research. In comparison with the U.S., we can say we have no corporate research. And we don't have not-for-profit organizations that take an idea right through to the process of designing a product for manufacture and selling it to somebody to do it. You know, Fraunhofer in Germany, Battelle in the States, ITRE in Taiwan are huge organizations very successful in doing this. We don't have them. We count on Canadian universities. Canadian universities have to rise to the challenge, but they have to be given adequate resources to do it.
Where might those resources come from?
The resources have to come from the federal government and the provincial governments. The provincial governments to fund the basic operation of the universities, the federal government to fund the actual research. The people in industry who are our partners in supporting university research put $1.84 on the table every time we put a dollar down in projects that are approved. They're doing their share, and there should be more such companies. But that part of it is getting better and better in Canada.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I was speaking with Dr. Tom Rostovsky, president of NSERC, the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada. Among the many presenters at the Sustainable Forest Management Conference was Dr. Suzanne Bailey, a professor in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Suzanne's research keeps her busy with the vast peatlands in the boreal forest. With the increased industrial activity in the north, both from forestry and oil sands development, the fens, bogs, streams, and rivers that make up these boreal wetlands could very well be at risk. So Suzanne and her group set out to determine an ecological baseline on water quality, and as she reported to the conference, the preliminary results were quite surprising.
We're looking to see what causes the natural, what is the natural water quality, how rich are these wetlands naturally, and then trying to infer what might be happening with timber harvesting. But we have to understand the natural before we can understand what changes might occur.
What are some of the things that you're finding? Are they pretty well the same all over the place, or do they vary quite a bit?
What we're finding is that there's quite a lot of variation for all the way from Manitoba through Saskatchewan to here in Alberta, with some wetland types being naturally very, very rich and, you know, almost pea green in color, and really people would say the water quality is terrible, but that's quite natural, while other areas, you know, they're absolutely spectacular, beautiful, with lots of vegetation and lots of waterfowl. And so we're trying to understand what's causing these patterns.
Do you have any indications? What is your data showing right now?
Well, we think that it might have to do with amount of rainfall. We think it might have to do with amount of phosphorus in the soils. So we don't understand the patterns yet, but we're starting to get some ideas. And one of the things that we're also starting to see is that maybe beaver can play a beneficial role in improving water quality.
Now, how is that?
Well, I think what it is that the beaver, if you're on a, say, a stream, the beaver have sequential dams downstream, and as, say, turbidity and sediment and nutrients come in, these are then retained and not swept right smack down to, say, bigger lakes and rivers. On the small isolated ponds that we're looking at, we're not actually sure why we have found improved water quality associated with beaver lodges or these are not river systems, and yet we're finding improved water quality. So we don't understand that yet.
Well, that must have been quite a surprise to you.
Yes, that actually was a surprise. And we're kind of hoping that the timber companies will be interested in this and be interested in maintaining their beaver to promote this, if in fact this is true across a large number of areas. We've only seen it right now in, say, two areas of Alberta. So I haven't looked on the Saskatchewan data yet.
What are some of the things that would actually be in the water that account for the different variations?
Well, the amount of organic matter in the water, the amount of light that there is in the water, whether the plants are there as sort of vegetation, sort of aquatic plants or seaweeds, as people sometimes call them, or whether it is algae. And so all of these then would determine, you know, what the chemistry of the water is and how much would, how dense the vegetation would grow. And, of course, that also then affects the waterfowl that would be coming in there and how heavily they're used.
Could you explain that a bit further?
Well, it seems that waterfowl like systems that are moderately rich. They don't like really nutrient-poor systems, and they don't like really as much the hyper-rich ones. So they seem to be sort of liking those systems best that are fairly rich, and we have quite a lot of them in boreal Alberta. And since we're losing all our prairie wetlands due to drought, these wetlands we see up north are going to be increasingly important.
This sounds like it's just the beginnings of trying to establish a basis. Where do you go to from here?
Well, we'd like to investigate a little bit more this role that these beaver are having in both maintaining water on the land in wetlands and possibly improving water quality out here in this type of system. These are very different from eastern Canada or British Columbia, and maybe it's something to do with that low flushing that we have out here that might be causing the results that we're getting. I think one thing that we have to be very concerned about is this long-term drought that we're in, which has already dried up most of our prairie wetlands. Our boreal wetlands may be the ones to go in the future. And without those, you know, where are our waterfowl going to be living?
Thank you very much, Suzanne.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Suzanne Bailey, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Over the last decade, trading carbon and sulfur credits as a way to offset industrial pollution has become an accepted practice. But can you imagine extending that practice to land use as a means of protecting biodiversity? It's a concept that Dr. Vic Adamovich introduced at the Sustainable Forest Management Conference in Edmonton. Vic is a professor in the Department of Rural Economy at the University of Alberta. He also holds the Canada Research Chair in Environmental Economics, and he's the program leader for the Sustainable Forest Management Network.
The idea actually comes from other environmental cases where there's what we call open access or use of a resource by a lot of different players without any cost to those players or any penalty. The notion is that you would then define a market that would have a maximum allowable use by all of the players cumulatively, so it addresses the cumulative effect, but then those players can trade based on who could best use that resource. If it's fisheries, they would trade rights to different fish species or to fish catch rates based on who's got the best ability to catch. If it's air pollution, they would trade rights to pollute. If it's carbon markets, they would trade carbon credits. This is just an application to land use where we would have a cap on development, so we'd maintain thresholds associated with habitat requirements, and essentially people could trade then their development rights to the best economic advantage.
It sounds there, though, that you have a much, much more complicated thing to deal with in terms of the land use because you have so many different players on the land base and you're also trying to protect biodiversity at the same time. Like, how do you deal with something that is just so complicated? How can you break it down?
I think there's two issues there. I don't think the issue of the different players on the landscape is a problem. When we think about air pollution, there are many different sources of air pollution. And in fact, that's why these systems work, because the firms are very different. Some can adapt and innovate and sell their permits to others who aren't so quick at adapting or innovating. And so the market actually arises from the differences in the players. So that part, I think, would be fine. The challenge, of course, is how do we set the thresholds or the caps? And there we need biological information as well as these sorts of global choices made by citizens as to what would they like to protect, where would they like to set the cap.
From a land use point of view, because the geography is so different, you have areas where you're dealing with forests and different kinds of forests, then you have forests and you have prairies, and you have completely, opposed different kinds of uses. Are there some limitations that you can deal with or restrictions that you put on in terms of how far afield you would go with these tradable land use permits?
Well, my answer to that would be you can't go too large, because there's just too much heterogeneity in the landscape types. You want to stay within some region where you can define for that region specific habitat requirements, and that those habitats are homogeneous in the sense that disturbing one unit in one place or leaving one unit in one place is the same as leaving another unit in another place in that same region. You go too far afield, then you lose those properties.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Vic Adamovich, professor of rural economy and holder of the Canada Research Chair in Environmental Economy at the University of Alberta. He's also a program leader for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Working with Vic is Dr. Marion Weber. As part of her postdoctoral research, she's looking at the mechanics involved in making tradable land use permits a viable program. A lot of that depends on computer modeling and simulations to test the underlying assumptions of tradable land use permits. I asked Marion what kinds of information she would put into these models.
Well, right now, we just treat all of the sectors in sort of a deterministic way. And what we'd like to do is get a more detailed perspective of how the different sectors would play out on the landscape. So, for example, modeling the linear impacts from oil and gas exploration and incorporate that and try to determine if we had a tradable permit system, who would be obtaining the rights, what a price would be, and how this would impact land use in terms of the configuration of habitat left over.
What are some of the things that would have to be in place before this sort of a process could go ahead?
Well, what you really need is a mechanism for setting thresholds at some sort of strategic level. So it could be through the government, or it could be through stakeholder groups that get together and agree upon some threshold values. You also need to have a monitoring system in place, so you have to have a defined level of attributes that you can track over time, and then you would want to feed those into other indicators and track those indicators and be able to go back to these larger strategic decision groups and evaluate whether you need to change your objective. So I think the key is that you need some mechanism for setting the threshold in a legal framework.
I think beyond that, too, how do you deal with things where you have industries such as the forest industries in Alberta, which work on they have certain areas of land that they can deal with. Then you have oil and gas that has certain leases to things. So they already have things there that they're dealing with. They've made agreements. And then you also have Aboriginal communities with reserves and those sorts of things. So how do you bring all of these things into play when people already have a prior arrangement on the land that they don't necessarily want to give up?
This is a good question. I think that to some extent you can deal with those issues through the allocation of rights initially, so that you could base it on historic use. You could base it on the rights that are already in place. So you could calculate the number of hectares that a forest company might have entitled to them under the current structure, and then grandfather those rights. What you're really doing is you're setting explicit habitat thresholds. And so things that these companies are already managing for implicitly are becoming explicit. So I don't see these as being necessarily incompatible with the existing institutions. For oil and gas companies, it would be much the same as the bidding system that they operate under currently, and the same thing for quota holders. So I think the major change would be in the level of planning that would be undertaken by FMA holders.
Who would be the bean counters in this process?
I think that the regulatory function of the government would, makes them the bean counter. And so I think it's up to the government to ensure that there is some mechanism for monitoring land use and making that data available to the public and to the users of the land base. I'm not saying that the government has to come up with the information, but they are responsible for making sure that that information is available in whatever framework they choose to acquire it.
What do you see as being the big challenge that you have to deal with now?
I think the key challenges are, one, dealing with some of the underlying assumptions regarding the quality of habitat. So this issue of letting go of the spatial configuration of how habitat lays out on the landscape, it's very contentious, and these are assumptions that really need to be tested in prototype studies. And the other main hurdle is going to be integrating a tradable land use rights system with the current tenures. So they're not necessarily incompatible, but it's going to take it will be a costly transition. And so developing mechanisms to compensate the players if that's necessary and setting up the institution, I think, will take a lot of thought.
It's something that seems so revolutionary. What would be the point of even trying to move in this direction?
Well, the point is the potentially huge cost savings for protecting biodiversity and reducing risk. And I think that particularly for large projects, there have been costly and protracted court cases related to cumulative effects. And I think that as the landscape becomes more congested, that this is going to happen more frequently. It imposes costs. And so it's going to help. It's going to create some clarity in terms of land use objectives. And I think that over time, that's going to reduce costs to firms and increase protection.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Marion Weber, a postdoctoral candidate in rural economy with the Sustainable Forest Management Network.
During the coffee breaks at the Sustainable Forest Management Conference, several people ended up over at the booth manned by conservation biologist Dr. Rick Schneider. There, Rick was promoting his new book, which is called Alternative Futures, Alberta's Boreal Forest at the Crossroads.
Perhaps just to start with the context for the book is the Alberta Forest Conservation Strategy. That was released about 5 years ago and involved almost all the forest stakeholders in the province, over 800 people. And the conservation strategy lays out a vision for how society in Alberta would like to see the forest managed, including a balance between economic objectives and ecological objectives, like maintaining the health of the forest and keeping biodiversity intact and that kind of thing.
There's an awful lot of work that has been going on in the scientific community in order to address, first of all, getting basic knowledge about what's out there in terms of biodiversity for our forests, and then also in terms of how to deal with new management systems, how to better integrate or incorporate science into the forest management. What is your assessment at this point compared to where we have been, say, since 5 years ago when the forest strategy was first put out?
Well, that's a good question. And basically, in the first half of the book, I conclude it. The first half is the section that looks at what we're doing today. And I conclude that with an analysis of how close are we to achieving the goals and the principles that are laid out in the Forest Conservation Strategy. And the unfortunate conclusion is we're quite a long ways off. If you look at the forestry sector, we're still managing on the basis of sustained yield, that is, maintaining the flow of timber to the mills, but not necessarily maintaining the integrity of the forest. And when you on the side of the petroleum sector, there's still really no rules as far as how much they can cut when they're cutting seismic lines and roads and well sites and pipelines, that kind of thing. There's no limit on how much can be cut per year, and no limits on a cumulative density, and no requirement to reforest. So we have yet to really engage on the in a meaningful way on the ground in terms of altered practices. On the other hand, through the work of these various research organizations, we do have a lot of the solutions in hand. I mean, it's no longer a question of what would we do instead. We actually have a fairly good idea of some of the alternative ways one could go about things if you wanted to do this balancing of ecological and economic objectives.
What are those alternatives?
Well, it depends to the sector, but maybe I should just start to say one of the important things is the integration. Right now, the way we do things is the forestry sector is managed by one government agency and petroleum by another and agriculture by another, and they're really not integrating what they're doing. So a forestry company might try to put out a plan to do things better, but yet the petroleum sector will come along and basically, without integrating its activities, put into disarray what the forestry company might be trying to do. So we need a single government agency looking over the management of the forest. There's only one forest. There really should be only one forest manager. And then, depending on the industry, if we're looking at the forest industry, this thing called the natural disturbance model has been put forward as probably the best solution as far as how we would cut trees in a better way. Now, in terms of the petroleum sector, it's not quite as simple as that because there's really no natural analog for roads or for the seismic lines. There's no equivalent to that. Like a fire does not cut along linear corridors. So the solution there is more of making it disappear. The forest industry has to cut trees. That's basically what it does for a living. Now, when it comes to the petroleum sector, well, trees are just something that get in the way. To access the resource that they want, which is under the ground, they can do that without doing as much damage as they do today.
Where do people get hold of your book?
It's published by the Federation of Alberta Naturalists, so they can phone up the Federation and order it there or on the Federation's website, www.fanweb.ca. It's also available at bookstores in Edmonton.
It's a great job. Thank you very much, Rick.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That was author and conservation biologist Dr. Rick Schneider. He's also the executive director of the Alberta Center for Boreal Studies. His book is titled Alternative Futures, Alberta's Forests at the Crossroads. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are available as audio files and as written transcripts from our website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.